Welcome to the September 2008 session of our International MD Support Group. Lilas G. Moak, MD, is founding director of the Henry Ford Visual Rehabilitation and Research Center in Livonia, Michigan. This is Dr. Moak's second presentation, as I said. We are happy to have her with us again, this time to share her knowledge about nutrition and AMD. I know you will get a great deal from what she brings to us today. Dr. Moak?
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks, Dan. I'm happy to be here. We say, as you're familiar with, what you see is what you get, and you are what you eat. So we put those two together, and we get our topic for this afternoon, which is what you see is what you eat. Americans and food are quite a topic. We diet, we gorge. We process, we go organic. We love fast foods, we love the Iron Chef. We have farms that look like factories and supermarkets that look like Taj Mahals. We want it all. The sweetness of Twinkies, the convenience of snack foods, the long shelf life of processed and packaged foods, the low consumer cost of industrial farming, and we want good health and good vision on top of it. And we're confused about nutrition since the topic is full of conflicting information. After years of at least thinking about cutting back on coffee, I read recently in the New York Times that coffee has more antioxidants than blueberries, and now it's good for you. So it's kind of go figure. Now, part of the reason for the conflicting information in nutrition is that there aren't very many controlled studies from which to draw firm conclusions. And that is in part because Western medicine has been late and slow in recognizing nutrition as a factor in health. Back some years ago, before I was in medicine, I suggested that we serve fruit juice in my kids' preschool instead of Kool-Aid. And that idea was met with a volley of objection, principally from another mom who said, quote, Kool-Aid is fine for them. And then she delivered the coup that ended the conversation, and that was, I'm a nurse, and I know. Well, I was sure she was wrong, but I had no credibility in that discussion. Now, that's not the only reason that I went to medical school, of course, but it may have added a little push, although, as it turned out, I didn't really learn anything about nutrition in medical school anyway, although this is starting to change, happily. Another part of the reason for the lack of proven information about nutrition is that Western medicine has traditionally focused on treatment rather than prevention, and medical insurances, as you know, pay for treatment, not for prevention. Nutrition, on the other hand, usually addresses prevention and minimizing risk. And yet another reason is studies are expensive, and the source of a lot of study money is drug companies. Nutritional supplements are not prescribed, and they have to simply compete on the open consumer market, so the profits are not as huge as they are for the drugs. And part of the reason for the confusion is that nutrition is a moving target. Our relationship with food, the way we grow, distribute, and consume it, has changed enormously in the last 50 years, which is when we began using pesticides and processing and developing industrial farming. Then global shipping began to take root, and the changes are continuing with corn fed to cows, hormones and antibiotics fed to most farm animals, genetically engineered food, mercury in the fish, and so forth. So the question of what's good for us and what's not good for us gets harder and harder to answer. And finally, nutrition as a factor in disease is much less obvious than bacteria that has fairly immediate impact and can be seen under a microscope. When a disease shows only in older individuals, it's hard to ascertain what factors over an entire lifetime are implicated. Age-related macular degeneration, as Dan just said, has come on strong as our population has gotten older. A man born in 1900 could expect to live to age 46. Today, life expectancy for men is 74, and for women, the gains have been even greater. A woman born in 1900 lived on average to age 48, and now life expectancy for women is 80. We're living so much longer, not primarily because of our nutrition, but because we have eliminated some of the major causes of death in young to middle-aged people. Public sanitation, blood transfusions, antibiotics, drugs to control hypertension and reduce the prevalence of strokes and heart attacks, plus the enforcement of worker safety standards, changes in weapons of war, and more recently, sophisticated diagnostics and surgeries, and new procedures for medical emergencies. We live a long time, but our longevity is bought at the enormous human and medical cost of chronic diseases. Autoimmune diseases are skyrocketing, osteoporosis and the chronic inflammation of arthritis, colitis, and a host of other itises are endemic among older adults. And digestive disorders are so common that advertisements for gastrointestinal remedies that combat constipation, bloating, gas, nausea, acid reflux, and general stomach discomfort overwhelm U.S. radio, TV, and print media. We live a long time, but few of us live those years without some chronic debilitating condition. Among the chronic diseases of aging eyes, macular degeneration has become the most formidable because it is so relentless and because it's so common, a veritable epidemic in the developed world and a major 21st century public health problem, as Dan also just said. There's a quote on this slide that says, "It's not an understatement to say that there is an impending epidemic of blindness," and I put in parentheses, "visual impairment from AMD." And that is a quote from Edwin Stone, who is an MD PhD researcher in this field. Vision loss impacts function more globally than virtually any other single physical deficit, and already the copay for the latest treatment for wet AMD is unaffordable for many who could benefit. Developing new treatments is important, but developing strategies for prevention is absolutely necessary. The question, then, is what role does nutrition play in treatment and prevention? Do we see what we eat or as well as we eat? I want to relate my answer to this question to our current understanding of how AMD happens, how it gets started, how it progresses, and what factors might be contributing. On the slide is just a model of an eyeball. The retina, as you know, is a thin film that lines the entire inside of our eyeball. And the macula is a small area at the very center of the retina, and it's the only part of the retina that provides detailed vision. The layers under the retina, the retinal pigment epithelium, or RPE, represented by the dark line under the yellow layer, and the choroid, which is the little pink layer under it, supply the retina and the macula with nutrition and dispose of its metabolic waste materials. When the cause and the process of a disease are not absolutely definitively known, biologists look at how the retina functions, epidemiologists look at who's getting AMD and what they have in common, geneticists look at the family clustering, clinicians track what the disease is doing to the macula, and together they construct a likely scenario of what happens. And this has produced a model that is as I'm going to describe. AMD is currently understood to be a combination of aging changes and pathological events. In both aging and AMD, free radicals injure the layers under the retina and the macula, the RPE and possibly the choroid. So the usual amount of injury associated with aging is compounded by AMD. Now, these free radicals that are doing the damage are electrically unstable molecules that need to be neutralized as soon as they're produced in the body, and the neutralizers are antioxidants, which we get from our food. So the first step in macular degeneration and the whole cascade of macular degeneration is that free radicals that aren't neutralized are causing injury to the macula. Okay. Next, this injuries, like injuries anywhere else in the body, triggers an inflammatory response. The inflammation, in turn, produces abnormal material that contributes to the formation of the white spots in the macula that are called drusen, that are the hallmark of macular degeneration. The drusen, and possibly also impaired circulation from other causes, interfere with the delivery of nutrients to the macula and with the removal of metabolic waste materials from the macula. So the macula doesn't get enough nutrients and gets bogged down with waste material, and both of those situations result in further damage. The further damage then causes more inflammation, and the cycle repeats itself over time, resulting in the atrophy or scarring of the macula and its supportive layers, again the RPE and the choroid, and in the abnormal new blood vessels of wet AMD that also produce atrophy and scarring. As we go through the environmental and nutritional risk factors that are known or suspected to play a role in AMD, I'll refer back to these basic three steps of free radical injury, number one, number two, inflammatory response, and number three, the blockage of nutrient flow. So how do these three steps relate to what we know for sure about AMD from environmental and nutritional studies? First, smoking is a proven risk factor for AMD, with people who smoke at least twice as likely to get AMD. And sure enough, smoking increases free radicals. It also decreases vitamin C absorption, and it decreases plasma levels of antioxidants that are the neutralizers of free radicals. So it contributes to the first step, free radicals, and it decreases circulation, so it contributes to the third step, the delivery of nutrients and removal of waste. So don't smoke. But the catch is that non-smokers share the risk, not only from secondary smoke from smokers in public buildings and outside, but also from the air itself. Since many of the estimated 4,000 toxic substances in cigarette smoke are also common in air and water pollutants in industrialized countries. Much of the groundwater in the USA contains halocarbons that are used in plastics and dry cleaning solvents, as well as pesticides, herbicides, and refrigerants. So the entire population has been exposed to these over the last several decades. And if you add to this our greater sun exposure than previous generations because of the thinning of the ozone layer, and overall our global industrial environment is producing a greater free radical load than was ever the case in the past. Free radicals, as I said, are neutralized by antioxidants, which we have to get from food. Nutritional research on AMD, therefore, focused first on antioxidants in food, notably with the age-related eye disease study called by its acronym AREDS, A-R-E-D-S. AREDS was a prospective, randomized, controlled, and double-masked, multi-centered study. This means that the patients were randomly given the nutritional supplement pills or placebos that looked just like the nutritional supplements, and neither the patients nor the doctors examining them knew who was getting which. The AREDS study had 3,609 participants, ages 55 to 80, who were followed for an average of 6.5 years. Some were given individual antioxidants, some were given different combinations of antioxidants, and the control group were given the placebos. Now, being in the placebo group may not be anyone's first choice, and there's a cartoon on the screen in which there are three pictures of the same guy, and he's saying three different things in each picture. And the first picture says, "I believe that in life we're divided into two groups." The middle picture says, "Now, my life is okay." And the third picture says, "But I think my group got the placebos." Now, many study participants didn't want to stop taking a multiple vitamin when they were already taking. So everyone in the study was allowed, even including the people who got the placebos, were allowed to take Centrum Silver no matter which group they were in. And 60% of all the participants did take another multiple vitamin, or Centrum Silver specifically. No difference was shown with the Centrum Silver, as it contains a lot of nutrients, but only very tiny amounts of each one. So to date, the AREDS remains the most comprehensive study on macular degeneration. The AREDS used four basic nutrients, 500 milligrams of vitamin C, 400 milligrams of vitamin E, 25,000 international units of beta carotene, which is 15 milligrams, 80 milligrams of zinc, and 2 milligrams of copper, which was just there to avoid copper deficiency with the increased intake of zinc. The best results were shown for those who took the combination that included all the supplements together and who began the study with moderate AMD or advanced AMD in one eye. 28% of those patients had a slower rate of progression of AMD compared to those who took any other combination or who took the placebo. The benefit was not observed for those with very early AMD or with no AMD. In the 6.5 years of follow-up time, neither those in the control group nor those in the treated group who began the study without AMD had developed it, so no comparison could be made. It might be that if the study had lasted for a longer time, then a benefit would have been shown, but we just don't know that one way or the other. Now, while 72% of the subjects in the study who took the combination of supplements did not show a benefit, the 28% figure that did benefit was significant enough to make the ARIDS formula a routine recommendation for patients with moderate or severe AMD. So why would the ARIDS formula help, and what do these results suggest about the pathogenesis of AMD? Now, if we look at the individual ingredients, we see that vitamin C and E are both antioxidants that counteract free radicals. That's step one. But vitamin C also tightens up capillaries, which might increase circulation, which is step three, or even prevent blood vessel leakage, which causes the damage in wet AMD. Vitamin E inhibits oxidation of low-density lipoproteins, the LDLs, the bad cholesterol, and thereby limits damage to blood vessels and helps stabilize cell membranes. In addition, the Scapins Institute in Boston showed a year or so ago that vitamin E inhibits oxidation of free radicals specifically from blue light, and it is the blue wavelengths that are highly suspected as those causing damage in AMD. Now, we all know that ultraviolet light is dangerous, but in our eyes, UV light, that's ultraviolet, is absorbed by our lens, so it doesn't get all the way back to the retina, and that's why we don't see UV light. The violet and blue wavelengths are right next to UV in the spectrum. It goes ultraviolet, violet, then blue. And they're almost as high energy as ultraviolet. And they do go through the lens and hit the retina, which is why we see the color blue. So vitamin E being helpful specifically with blue light is significant. Now, zinc, another ARIDS ingredient, is essential in forming melanin. And melanin, which is what gives us color in all parts of our bodies, protects us from free radical damage from light. Just as individuals with darkly pigmented skin don't burn in the sun the way those with pale skin do, so more melanin in the layer under the retina, again that RPE, the retinal pigment epithelium, may protect the macula from sun as well. Zinc is also essential for enzymes in the retina that scavenge other free radicals, and for the formation of digestive enzymes that help us absorb nutrients from food. And copper, as I said, is just there to avoid a copper deficiency. Beta-carotene is also a basic nutrient for retinal function, as it is converted to vitamin A in the liver, and then converted to rhodopsin in the retina. Now, there are some concerns about beta-carotene, because later studies suggest that beta-carotene supplementation may not be desirable after all, because it is converted to vitamin A, and vitamin A is now understood to actually play a role in the formation of drusen when the retina is subject to oxidative stress, which is exactly the situation with AMD. Now, beta-carotene supplementation was already not recommended for smokers because of a study in which coal miners who smoked were given very high doses of beta-carotene, double the dose in the ARIDS study, on the theory that the beta-carotene would help prevent lung cancer in these high-risk individuals. But what actually happened is that the miners who took the megadose of beta-carotene developed more lung cancer than those taking the placebo, so the study was discontinued. This unexpected result could have been because smokers don't metabolize beta-carotene in the same way non-smokers do, or because beta-carotene was given by itself. Now, we are used to dealing with drugs which act on their own, but nutrients work as a team. Some are water-soluble, some are fat-soluble, and they team up to be effective in all metabolic situations. Doomed in a very high dose may therefore not function the same as it would if it was given with a group of nutrients. By the same token, interactions between nutrients may be important, especially when we're considering supplementation in fairly high doses. For example, beta-carotene and lutein are both transported in our bodies by HDLs, the good cholesterol. So it has been suggested that taking beta-carotene supplements may reduce the body's capacity to metabolize lutein and therefore have adverse effects on the retina. If both are taken as supplements, it might therefore be advisable to take them at different times of the day. And this is not yet known for sure, and the impact of lutein on AMD is not definitively known either, although lutein has already become kind of a household among the general public with respect to AMD. Now, the first ARID study did not include lutein or zeaxanthin, as they were not commercially available at the time that that ARIDS was designed. A second ARID study is now underway that is including both lutein and zeaxanthin along with essential fatty acids. Lutein and zeaxanthin are carotenoids, and they are the most ancient protectors against sunlight in photosynthetic bacteria and in plants, where they enable photosynthesis. Since they are the only carotenoids found in the lens and the retina, it's long been thought that their function in the lens and the retina may be to provide protection from free radical damage from the sun. A number of studies in the last 10 to 15 years have supported the hypothesis that lutein and zeaxanthin help protect the macula from free radical damage. And the first one of those was Johanna Seddon's study at Harvard in 1994. She did an extensive dietary history study that showed that individuals who ate 5 servings a week or more of dark green leafy vegetables had 43% lower prevalence of AMD. When they looked at what's in the dark green leafy vegetables, like kale and to a lesser degree spinach, they found lots of lutein. And it's lutein that helps protect dark green leaves from sun damage. Dr. Seddon's study did not prove that eating the vegetables is what caused the decreased prevalence of AMD. As to prove it, it requires that randomized controlled masked study like the ARIDS. But it showed such a strong correlation that it got everybody's attention. A second Harvard study looked at the relationship between levels of carotenoids in the blood and AMD and found that those who had high levels of carotenoids in their blood had 30% lower risk for AMD, and those with the highest levels of carotenoids had 50% lower risk. Again, this doesn't prove cause and effect, but it just lines up kind of more evidence. So those two studies showed that those who ate a lot of lutein had less AMD, and those who had high levels of carotenoids, of which lutein is one, in their blood had less AMD. So the link between those two studies came in a twin study that showed that it was lutein in food that produced high blood levels of carotenoids. The researchers gave one identical twin a diet high in lutein and the other a diet low in lutein, and their blood levels were measured for lutein. Sure enough, the twin who ate more lutein had a higher level of lutein in the blood. So the researchers concluded that food intake rather than genetic predisposition regulates lutein level. The next step in the puzzle was to see if there was a connection between the level of lutein in the blood, the level of lutein in the macula, the density of macular pigment, and AMD. So one study compared 56 eyes with AMD to 56 control eyes and found that the eyes with AMD had lower levels of both lutein and zeaxanthin and less macular pigment. And then the other researchers showed the same result. Now, to link all these findings with macular function, the Veterans Administration Hospital in Chicago conducted a randomized control trial, double-masked, in 2004, in which 90 patients were given one of 3 supplements for 12 months, either lutein or lutein with an antioxidant combination or a placebo. The groups taking lutein alone and the combination not only had higher pigment density, but they also had improved visual acuity and improved contrast sensitivity and improvement in glare recovery. Those taking the combination of lutein and other antioxidants had a 3.5-letter improvement in acuity. Those taking lutein by itself had a 5.4-letter improvement. Now, these patients in the VA study, as you might expect, were older veterans and therefore men. So one question is whether the results would have been different if women had been included in the study. And the reason that that might be a factor is because other studies have suggested that the retina interacts with adipose tissue in lutein metabolism, and that the relationship of lutein concentration in adipose or fat tissue and macular pigment density is different for males and females, and therefore that males and females may metabolize lutein differently. Just another little complexity in nutritional research. Okay, next slide, please. Now, lutein and zeaxanthin are often mentioned as interchangeable, and they are cousins of each other, but there are some differences. Lutein is far more plentiful in our food supply. Fruit, for example, contains 7 to 10 times more lutein than zeaxanthin, and fruit intake may be correlated to lower risk for AMD. Lutein may also be concentrated preferentially in rods and zeaxanthin in cones, which might suggest that zeaxanthin is the most important to AMD since the macula has a high concentration of cones. And in fact, for centuries, the Chinese have been eating small tart berries called Lycium barbarum, or wolf berries in English, for their eyes, and as it turns out, these berries are extremely rich in zeaxanthin. You can actually get wolf berries dried at health food stores and on the internet. Evidence that zeaxanthin is at least as important as lutein in protection against AMD has been produced in a study at Scapin's of Japanese quails, of all things, whose maculas are similar to humans in that they have both rods and cones, as well as selective uptake of lutein and zeaxanthin. The researchers divided the Japanese quails into two groups that were fed a normal diet or a lutein-rich and zeaxanthin-rich diet, respectively, and then they subjected half of each group to intensive light for 10 one-hour sessions, separated by 2 hours in the dark. At the end, after 14 hours in the dark, the quails were sacrificed, which is the research term for killed. One retina of each quail was then measured for the concentration of the carotenoids, and in the other retina of the same quail, they counted the number of dead photoreceptor cells. The results showed that the retinas of the quails who were fed a normal diet were damaged by the light, but the quails that were fed zeaxanthin were protected, and the results for lutein were just about the same. They found that the higher the number of dead rods and cones, the lower the concentration of macular carotenoids. So, to review, we know from the ARID study that the risk of AMD is reduced for a significant minority of those who take the combination of vitamin C, E, zinc, and beta-carotene. Many smaller studies have elucidated the potential role of lutein and zeaxanthin in protecting the macula, and that mountain of evidence is growing. The final definitive step will be the large, long-term prospective study that is going on right now, a second ARID study in which lutein and zeaxanthin are included. Now, all the nutrients we've discussed so far combat free radicals from sunlight and other sources, and some support cell membranes and some inhibit blood vessel damage. So they play a role in two of the steps in our hypothetical sequence of AMD. The first step is the oxidation of free radicals, and the third, circulation. The middle step, inflammation, has recently come on the scene big time, with evidence mounting as to its role, and it's become a very hot topic in AMD. To measure inflammation, researchers measure levels of C-reactive protein, which is a marker for inflammation in our bodies, and different researchers have come up with different findings. The Beaver Dam Eye study looked at frozen blood samples from 188 people with early AMD and from 195 without AMD, and found no correlation between AMD and C-reactive protein. Dr. Seddon at Harvard, on the other hand, studied 257 people and found that those with the highest levels of C-reactive protein had twice the risk of AMD compared to the lowest. She and the Third National Health and Nutritional Examination Survey, which is a great big major study, also found that increased levels of C-reactive protein were present in smokers, in those who were obese, and increased levels of C-reactive protein were found in those who had lower levels of lutein. So the whole circle starts to turn on itself. Now, genetic researchers have weighed in on this topic because they have identified a gene variant that affects inflammatory response, and people who have that gene variant have 3 to 7 times the risk, greater risk for AMD than other people. The gene involved encodes a protein, complement factor H, called CHF, that has the job of reducing one path of inflammation and putting the brakes on C-reactive protein. But the most remarkable correlation came from a study of arthritis patients who take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications for arthritis. These patients had only one-tenth the prevalence of AMD of those of their same age who were not taking anti-inflammatory medications. The researchers were so surprised at these results, they didn't even believe the figures initially, and they had to recheck them and repeat them before they actually announced the results. Another very interesting twist is that at the same time chronic inflammation is gaining prominence as a factor in AMD, so are fatty acids. And it may be that these two factors are related, that nutrition has a role even in the second step of inflammation. First, several studies have related fatty acid intake to AMD. A Harvard study completed in 2001 followed 42,000 women from the Nurses' Health Study for 12 years and followed almost 30,000 men age 50 or older for 10 years to track their fat intake, which they documented on food frequency questionnaires. Over the 12 years, 567 individuals developed AMD, and their total fat intake did correlate with the risk of AMD. But to the delight of beef eaters everywhere, vegetable fat had a higher correlation to AMD than animal fat. Dr. Seddon then published a study in 2003 of 261 people who filled out food frequency questionnaires for an average of 4.5 years, in which she found that high intake of vegetable oils puts people at higher risk for AMD, and high intake of fish lowered the risk. In Dr. Seddon's study, saturated, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated, and trans fats and food groups with high levels of these fats, for example, processed baked goods, all increased the progression of AMD, and fish and nuts were protective. Now, to understand the implications of these studies, I want to talk for a bit about fatty acids. They have many functions in our bodies, but the one of interest in this context is their role in inflammation. Omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids are the only two fatty acids that our body can't make. We must get them from our food, and that's why they're called essential fatty acids. Omega-6 fatty acid comes principally from corn oil, which is the USA's biggest crop, and from soybean oil and other light vegetable oils, and from animals that have consumed those plants. Omega-6 produces arachidonic acid, which also comes from butter, animal fats, especially pork, organ meats, egg yolk, and seaweeds. And arachidonic acid is the source of series 1 and 2 prostaglandins, which promote inflammation in response to injury or stress. Now, this inflammatory reaction is essential in crisis conditions, in response to an injury, for example. We all really need that quick inflammatory reaction. But if the rate of it is too fast or too steady, then excess series 2 prostaglandins are produced. That causes excess inflammation, more inflammation, and for longer than we need an inflammatory response. Now, omega-3 comes from flax oil, nuts, and green vegetables, and it produces two important products, DHA and EPA. EPA and DHA both also come directly from fish liver oils and fish eggs, and DHA is also found in human milk, organic egg yolks, liver, brain, and other organ meats. DHA is a major part of photoreceptor membranes and makes up more than a third of the fatty acid content in our retinas and our brain's gray matter. The Japanese have long considered eggs, which are rich in DHA, as brain food. EPA, the other product of omega-3 fatty acid, produces the series 3 plus prostaglandins, which helps control inflammation, like in asthma and arthritis. Okay, next slide. So the first important fact is that the production of series 2 prostaglandin starts with omega-6 fatty acids from vegetable oils, and the series 2 prostaglandins promote inflammation. The second important fact is that the production of series 3 prostaglandins begins with omega-3 fatty acids from fish and flaxseed, and that series 3 prostaglandins decrease inflammation. Okay, so we've got omega-6s encouraging inflammation, omega-3s minimizing inflammation. The third important fact is that the production of these two prostaglandins requires the same enzymes. And this is kind of a complicated slide that just shows omega-6 and omega-3 and what their chemical reactions are. But what's important to look at is in the middle of that are two chemicals listed, two enzymes in green on this slide. But the take-home message is that both omega-6 and omega-3 need to use those same enzymes for their chemical reactions. Okay. This means that the omega-6s and the 3s have to be present in our bodies in an appropriate ratio so that one doesn't swamp the other and use up all the enzyme. Ideally, we should have 4 times as much omega-6 as omega-3. So just keep that figure in mind, 4 times as much omega-6 as omega-3. And the reason that I want you to keep that ratio in mind is because this is where things go awry in the U.S. Without even realizing it, we consume tons of omega-6 fatty acids from soybean oil, corn oil, cottonseed oil, safflower oil that are introduced into our food supply without our realizing it. Not only are these vegetable oils that are rich in omega-6 fatty acids used to make the increasing number of low-fat foods on the market, and I'll say more about this in a minute, but they're also added to virtually every food that comes in a package, which means almost everything in the supermarket. When Johanna Seddon's study first appeared that implicated these omega-6 fatty acids from vegetable oils, one of our occupational therapists and I went to a large local convenience store and we looked at every single food item on the shelves. And we found only 4 things that did not contain vegetable oils, and that was mustard, ketchup, relish, and pistachio nuts. Everything else, all the cereals, the granola bars, the canned and packaged foods, the microwave popcorn, all the snack foods, 3 kinds of ice cream, all contained either corn oil, soybean oil, safflower oil, or some kind of light oil. So at least in the U.S., we are all getting huge amounts of omega-6 fatty acids without even realizing. Conversely, the modern American diet is deficient in omega-3 fatty acids, in part because there are limited sources of it, and except on the coasts, we tend to be a meat-eating rather than a fish-eating society, and in part, some believe, because of our modern farming methods. So our ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 is therefore badly askew. Now remember that the optimum ratio is 4 to 1, 4 times as many omega-6 as omega-3. But estimates are that the average American diet gives us a ratio in the neighborhood of 20 to 1, 5 times more omega-6 than we should have, largely because of the amount of processed and packaged foods we eat. That means that we produce a steady supply of the prostaglandins that promote inflammation, and their production uses up all the enzymes, so we don't produce much of the prostaglandin that modulates inflammation. This is a setup for chronic inflammation that's so common in our society, in diseases from asthma to Alzheimer's, and now implicated in AMD. So in a nutshell, again, step one of our model AMD, free radical damage, is increased by smoke, pollutants, and sunshine, and decreased by antioxidants. Step two, inflammation, is increased by a diet of foods that are processed and packaged, and packaged foods, and those containing artificial fats, and decreased by fish and flaxseed. The message, of course, is that a good diet is good for all of us, for everything. But the bigger question is, can we actually get the nutrients we need from food if we do everything right? And nobody knows that for sure, but I think there are some persuasive arguments that we cannot, at least in the U.S. First, as we've discussed, all of us in industrial societies are subject to a heavy free radical load from our environments over which we have very little control, which means we need extra antioxidants to counteract them beyond the antioxidants that our grandparents needed. Second, the people getting AMD are the healthy ones, the ones who live to ripe old ages. If they'd been making all the wrong food choices and abusing their diets all their lives, they would have died of strokes or heart attacks before they ever got AMD. They are likely to be eating relatively well, and yet they are still not getting enough antioxidant nutrients from their food to protect them. What we tend not to consider is the impact of industrialization and industrial food production in particular on the nutritional content of our food. During the last 50 years in the U.S., we have radically changed our farming practices with the rise of agribusiness as well as our food processing and packaging. And the quality of our soil and water has eroded with the production and distribution of tens of thousands of household and industrial chemicals. We no longer rotate crops. We spray the plants with the same chemicals that increase free radicals. We pick the fruits and vegetables early and spray them with more chemicals so they look fresh, and we ship them to the grocery store 2 weeks later. So even if we avoid packaged foods and buy all fresh produce, we're not getting the nutrient content our grandparents got in the same fruit and vegetables, at least in the U.S. In addition, we are exposed to extra chemicals, some of whose effects we don't yet understand, and others we've found to be damaging. And a case in point with this last point is trans fats. If you add hydrogen to a vegetable oil, you get partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, which is solid at room temperature, for example, margarine as compared to butter. For those with a chemistry bent, the process of hydrogenating a molecule of vegetable oil changes its double bonds from cis to trans formation, and that's where it gets its name, trans fats. The FDA has not required that these artificial fats be labeled as fat, and thus we have non-fat cookies, cakes, and other baked goods that everyone thinks are good for them because we have been told that fat is bad. But actually, trans fats are worse than real fat, and they're actually not really food at all. When my favorite chocolate chip cookies first appeared with no fat written on the package, I joked that they must be made out of cardboard because you can't make a cookie without fat. And it turns out that while they actually taste like cookies, they might as well be made out of cardboard because the trans fats they contain are not molecules that occur in nature, and our bodies cannot metabolize them naturally. They are incorporated into our bodies, presumably into the retina, which is a very fatty tissue, but they are not processed and disposed of normally, and they may turn out to be a factor in the deposition of waste materials in AMD, although this is not proven. You can think of it a little like the trash collectors in our community as compared to the recycling collectors. They each pick up the specific waste material that's assigned to them. Our body's metabolic trash collectors don't recognize molecules that don't occur in nature, and it's not their job to pick them up. Trans fats also inhibit the action of that first enzyme on the prostaglandin pathway, and lo and behold, inhibition of this enzyme is associated with high cholesterol, which has been linked with AMD, which AMD patients. So why do we make trans fats? Well, because it's profitable. It's cheaper to hydrogenate plentiful, inexpensive vegetable oils than to use real fat, and it's easy to market it by calling it low fat. There's some hope that we're entering a new area of nutrition and food processing awareness, and in fact, in New York City, trans fats have just been vetoed. So, in summary, we don't know an enormous amount about nutrition and AMD, but we know enough to say that, at least to some degree, what you see or how well you see depends on what you eat. Food selection is important, with emphasis on fruits, vegetables, fish, nuts, and whole grains, minimizing dairy and red meat, and avoiding trans fats and processed and packaged foods as much as possible. But food production, and this is all steps from growing to processing to packaging to distribution, is also important. And all of us, certainly those of us in healthcare, but all individuals, should help focus attention on the quality of food that's available rather than to consider nutrition exclusively a problem of individual eating habits. Until food production changes so that food contains sufficient antioxidant power to counteract the challenges of our industrial environments, I personally don't believe it's possible to obtain full nutrition for the health of your eyes and the rest of your body in food alone, at least in the U.S. And therefore, I believe that nutritional supplements are important. A well-made multiple vitamin mineral for everyone, and for those at particular risk, then the nutrients in the amounts in the ARID study. Some ophthalmologists recommend only that for individuals with AMD because that's what's been proven. And I think that while not proven, there's enough evidence for lutein, zeaxanthin, omega-3 fatty acids that I routinely recommend them for patients with AMD and those at high risk as well, since in reasonable doses they are not known to be harmful. For a very interesting story of the food industry in the U.S., I recommend Michael Pollan's book, it's P-O-L-L-A-N, Pollan, called The Omnivore's Dilemma. And there's more about nutrition and AMD along with recipes for greens also in our book about AMD. And I'm very much looking forward to the results of the second ARID study and hopefully to many more studies on nutrition. With enough research, maybe we will be able to influence industrial food production and decrease the risk of chronic diseases for our whole population. And in the meantime, I wish you all good health and a long lifetime in which to enjoy it. And thanks all.